So I thought I would sort of round this off with a little bit of maybe some reflections on why it's important to practice with this. In this setting here, when we do a retreat like this, it can give us a misperception of what it is that practice is all about. But because of the way we live as lay practitioners, we have to do it in a setting like this. So on one hand, this kind of a setting where it's quiet, we hold it in noble silence, we sit, we walk, we sit, we walk, we don't really do anything except for the practice itself all day. This is the kind of setting that can help your nervous system settle down so you can see. If we try to do this with a lot of stuff going on, the nervous system won't settle down. And when our nervous system is on high alert, it pretty much blocks out any kind of wisdom. It's like on a mission, and that mission is to save you from whatever impending doom is coming. And so it won't listen or hear or experience anything other than its direct threat awareness level. That's it. It's on red alert, and that's all it's looking for is threats. So we have to come into an environment that is quiet and does not have a lot of stimulation that gets us riled up and keeps us kind of contained, so we can let the nervous system relax. And when the nervous system starts to relax, then we can start seeing phenomena. We can understand and perceive the Dhamma. For those of you that weren't here last night, I was telling about this story about a monk named Pukkasati. And Pukkasati he lived during the Buddha's time. When the Buddha was alive, when the Buddha was born, there was no Buddha. So there was no wisdom of Buddha in the world. And we take it for granted that it's in the world right now because we can practice with it. But at the time of the Buddha's birth, the wisdom of Buddha, so the wisdom of how to awaken your mind, how to get out of suffering from the way we just live and die. We just go through life. This is all there is, fighting our way through and die. And so the wisdom of a Buddha's capacity to teach someone that you actually hold the key to your own awakening, your own wisdom, your own knowing, that didn't exist. And so Buddha, like many other people of his day, went searching for that wisdom. Everybody was trying to find it. And we happen to live, what I was saying last night was that we live in a Buddha ending era. So the Buddha has died and his wisdom exists, but it will at some point diminish. And it will be forgotten. And when that happens, another Buddha has to come in the world. And so how that happens, you just don't know. Anyway, so the Buddha, he leaves home looking for the Buddha wisdom, just like everybody else. And he finds it. He finds this path. What he said is he found a path that was all had grown over, like when you're bushwhacking out there in the backwoods, you're reestablishing a path that existed. So he didn't make this up. He found it. Through trial and error, he found this process. And not only did he find it, but he was able to convey it, say it. And when he said it, another being, one of his friends, got awakened. So he could convey it, you could understand it, and then you could apply it in that moment and get awakened. So I'm sure, I mean, since the Buddha's not here, we all got to do it the hard way. You know, there's probably an easier way. If we had the Buddha here, we could just be in his presence, and that kind of happens. But yeah, no, we who are existing 2,700 years from his death, we have to do it the hard way, find it ourselves. But in this process, Buddha became Gotama. He was Siddhartha before then. He became Gotama. And Gotama became known, very famous. A lot of people knew, because anyone that could come around him could get the teachings direct and they could see. And in that seeing, they could awaken. And so there's several people who, the Buddha Bahiya is another one. The Buddha just spoke to him, told him what to do, and he got awakened. So when I say awakened, I don't mean he like floated off into the wilderness. I mean he understood life. So in that moment, that's what I think awakening is. You understand and you stop fighting with life anymore. So anyway, the Buddha's going to Suvati. And along the way, he comes upon this owner, this inn, and he wants to stay in the barn. And the owner says, sure, but there's somebody already there. And it turns out it's Venerable Pukkasati. And Venerable Pukkasati, he's on his way to Suvati too, because he hears that his teacher is in Suvati. And his teacher is Master Gotama. So he's going to see him. He's taken his vows. He's entered the order. He's never met the man. He's never seen him, never had anything to do with him, but he's heard what he's supposed to do, and that's what he's been practicing. So the Buddha asked Venerable Pukkasati if he could stay there, and they said yes, and the two of them are sitting there, and they're practicing. And he's diligent in his practice. He's not doing it the right way, but he's diligent in his practice nonetheless. He's doing what he thinks the Buddha says he should do, and he is diligent with it. And so the Buddha takes, you know, feels a little compassion for him. He respects his sincerity and his willingness, his persistence, and he asked him, who's your teacher? And Pukkasati, I said last night, said, it's Venerable Gotama. And he says, oh, where's this Venerable Gotama? He's in Suvati. I'm going to visit him. So the Buddha says, have you ever met Venerable Gotama? It's like, no, I haven't met him. But he says, have you ever met him? Would you know what he looked like if you saw him? And he's like, no, I've never seen him, but I'm going to see him now. I'm on my way. And the Buddha feels this level of compassion and begins to teach him the four foundations to help him see. And I was saying last night that in the sutta, the more the Buddha taught him, the more he began to see. And then he realized that the Buddha was sitting there right there in the room with him. And he it's what happens to us when we practice in a setting like this, right? Where it's quiet, where you don't have a lot of the worldly distractions. You can begin to see something. So you can begin to see in a different way. And you can begin to understand in a different way. Now we have to take this seeing that we have, and we have to take it with us out into this world that's a different world. So we don't have to force that world to be quiet like this. And that's sometimes, I think, what began to happen to a lot of the early practitioners in the Insight tradition, is we would go on retreat and have these beautiful experiences, and then we would come home and try to make everybody in the house settle down and be like on retreat. Make our whole lives be like retreat, because we thought that we experienced these incredible ways of being that we didn't even know we could be that way. And then when we'd come home, we would start losing it on everyone. So our natural inclination is make everything be like retreat, and then I can be okay. But, you know, I'm saying this because this is what I did for years when I started going on retreat. I kept coming home trying to make my life be like retreat. I should say more directly, try to make my family be like the people on retreat. That was not going to happen. And so I would lose it and feel dejected, like somehow or another, whatever I learned on retreat, I lost it. But that's not actually what we're doing here. So that's why I started reframing this understanding of the four foundations of mindfulness. We're not trying to, in the first foundation, we're not trying to just stay with the breath. Can I just stay with the breath, stay with the breath, stay with the breath? And then when you're in retreat like this, and if you're in longer retreat, yeah, you can stay with the breath. It's all quiet. There's nothing but the breath. Of course you can stay with it. But when you go home, the breath seems very, 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 very far away. But the sense doors are not. The sense doors you can see, you can hear, you can feel, touch, smell, taste. It's very much alive when we go home. And we see a lot of that phenomena all the time. And so when you get caught up in some moment, you can shift your focus to seeing, hearing. I can remember my meditative practice, the best meditative practice I did during moments of great anxiety and panic attacks that I would have in the house, was washing the dishes. And I would stand there at that sink with the warm water, the soapy water, the hard dishes, and I would begin to wash these dishes in the elements. And I could turn away from the frantic thinking into this washing of dishes and put the dishes away. And then once I washed all the dishes, if I was still anxious, I'd just put them all on the other side and wash them again. And I would just keep washing them until I settled down. But some people I know, they take showers. That helps them settle down. They take baths. They settle down. So your sensory experiences, because they're happening in the direct moment, present moment experience, they can help you come into the present moment. That's actually the only thing we've done today, is I've spent the day helping you come into the present moment. And this is what the present moment feels like. This is what it is. Even if you're at home, this is what it feels like. It's quiet. You have sounds. You have sensations. You have experiences. But really, you're just sitting here doing nothing. And that's the truth. You're just sitting here doing nothing. And so this is what it feels like. If we were doing something, cleaning up the temple, doing this, doing that, it would feel a little bit more lively. But the present moment itself is just reflecting what you're actually doing. And so at this moment, what we're doing is sitting. And so the present moment is still. And then when we get ready to, you know, leave, it'll be more lively. But the sense doors are to help you come into the present moment. That's what the first foundation is designed for, to help you come into the present moment. And whatever that looks like, that's what we're establishing. Second foundation helps you come into the moment with this experience of Vedana. So this somehow we're being brought into that moment with this constant kind of a quantitative tag about the moment. Whether the moment's pleasant or unpleasant or neither, that tag is also showing up in the moment. And so that tag is pushing us. If we like it, it's pushing us into taking it, trying to hold on to it. If we don't, then we're trying to push it away and ignoring. So this Vedana is also pushing our intentions. These intentions we have, sometimes those intentions are not necessarily skillful, right? Because sometimes our intention is to get something. I want that. So I'm going to get that. And we can, in our greed, grab after things. Things we like. That's what we do. We like it, so we try to get it. We try to keep it. This part of the reason why we'd have so much trouble when we leave retreat and we come home. Because I liked it when it was quiet and still. You come home and your partner likes the TV on all the time. So then you are trying to force them not to do that. Not because it is bad that the TV's on or not on. Because in theory, you could just notice this hearing. But because you have a judgment, this intention to have silence. And so we get trapped in the wanting silence and push everything else away. We just need to see what we're doing. Because if you could see that you really just want silence. It's not that the TV is bad. It's just I want silence. You could think of another way of actually experiencing silence. I cannot believe that it's so easy to have noise reducing earplugs. That is the best thing since sliced bread. I mean, you put those things in and it changes the sound of things. And sometimes when I come home from retreat, I wear them all the time. All the time, all the time, all the time. Because the sounds are so grating on the nerves that instead of me snapping at everybody like I used to, I actually can put these noise-reducing earplugs in and not listen to music and instead just be quiet. Helps me settle down. Helps me realize that's what I'm so irritated about. It's not I'm irritated at people. I'm just irritated at the level of sound. And I put the earplugs in. Settle down some. So this beginning to see the Vedana, you can begin to see what's driving your reactivity. Because that Vedana is going to drive reactivity. So what's driving your reactivity? And if you see what's driving your reactivity, you can adjust to whatever the experience is. You don't have to change the experience, is what I'm pointing to. You have to adjust to the experience in a way that supports you. And so this is what we're learning how to do. But the learning to see Vedana in a quiet place helps you know that this is a Vedana thing here. This is not their, crazy. So I thought my family was just over the top. They're not. I live with Sean and Jeff. And when I come around, they're like, probably, wow, she is loud. She is noisy. That's the way my family was. But they're very quiet. You could barely tell they're in the room, like very quiet. So that kind of loudness is inherent in the way I was raised. So we're all loud people. But when I would come home from retreat, they seemed loud and I seemed quiet. But actually, it's not they're loud. I'm loud. And so I had to learn that it was just this judgment, the Vedana of disliking that sound. This is what we're doing. We're taking these experiences and we're seeing first foundation, second foundation, and then when we go home in our lives, we're beginning to recognize the influence it's having and the possibility that we can have of being more steady with whatever's showing up. So tomorrow we're going to talk about the third foundation and the fourth foundation. We're going to talk about minds and emotions, the thinking mind and emotions, which can really get things going. And then the Dhammas. And then that is the whole of the Dhamma, actually. The four frames is the whole of the Dhamma. It's volume after volume after volume in the Pali Canon. If you were to see it up here, it's huge. But all of it boils down to the four frames. It's just hard to stay with these frames. And so that's why we keep practicing, keep remembering. That's why we stay together, because no one feels uncomfortable walking slow next to someone here. You can feel uncomfortable trying to practice in other settings, but here you don't feel uncomfortable. So we stay together, practice, and then go out in the world and try to live with these practices, these frames.